Nearly got a try on that left-hand side. What happened?
Oh, but I've gone up and over and bloody head over biscuit. It wasn't enough stability there for myself, but no, I was busting for a bit of meat this game. It didn't seem to work out.
Hello, cheers, and welcome to the Scrum of the Earth podcast, the weekly show that brings you news, reviews, great interviews, and so much more all about the world of rugby. I'm your host, David Lawrence. I'm an American rugby fan who follows the game wherever I can find it, all over the globe. If you'd like to get in touch, I'd love to hear from you. I'm easy to find on all your usual socials. And if you're old school, you can just drop an email to thescrumoftheearth@gmail.com. Well, as you have no doubt deduced by now, this is not your regular weekly episode, but it's in fact yet another bonus episode today. I'm absolutely thrilled to welcome a brand new guest to the pod. He's one half of the 8-9 Combo Rugby Podcast, which is a show that is arguably the best South African, American, Australian rugby podcast in the world, blending the perfect combination of passion, humor, nonsense, and genuine insight. I'm talking, of course, of the globetrotting rugby poet himself, Mr. Harry Jones. Harry, welcome to the show, and how are you doing?
How's it, David Lawrence? Good to be on. I'm doing fine, actually. It's been a wonderful year of rugby with passion. I think there's been a fair amount of suspense. And I cannot wait to get into it with you, and let's see what we can talk about.
So I've been listening to your show. You're a man after my own heart. You cover almost everything, and you speak with authority in each case. How much rugby do you actually watch in a given week?
I actually just watch just about everything. It's top line stuff. I don't watch the bottom dwellers or anything. I try to watch top of the tables. I have an insatiable appetite for it. So it kind of overlaps with what I work. I'm a rugby fixer. I'm a global lawyer by trade, but that actually helps me get into representing some of our rugby nations. Like, I help some Pacific Island nations get their money ahead of time for the World Cup this time instead of on the back end. Wow. I work with some clubs in top 14. I'm heavily into the South African rugby scene as well as the Australian. So for me, it's kind of I have to watch it. If I don't watch it, I don't have credibility. I do think that in rugby, contrary to some people's opinion about stoppage time and ball not in play, it's actually ideal when you're catching up on a game, a replay, to be able to fast forward. So I'm not really complaining about it. I think you can whip through a game in 45 minutes.
So I have an overwhelming sense that you're someone I'm going to want to have back to chat many times in the future. So today I just kind of wanted to paint with the broadest brush possible. Can I give you some sort of random questions from the various comps I think we both pay attention to?
Sure. Let's go.
Okay, I'll call it a tight five. Question the first. The Crusaders are 0-5 right now. Should they just completely mail it in the rest of the way? And did their new coach just walk into an impossible situation?
You know, I think every time there's something that happens in a team, the reflexive thing is to look at the head coach and head coach alone. It's obviously a much more multifarious problem over there, the Crusaders. Like, there's nothing, like, they didn't become a bad rugby region overnight. It's a watershed region. It's the catchment system in Canterbury, Christchurch, that so many good players are playing right now in Auckland that actually belong in the Crusader world. So it's a simple fix on retention of talent in some ways, but at the same time, you look at the numbers about a year ago and you knew this was coming. There's only one player that took the field a couple of weeks ago that was in the title-winning Crusaders 6 months ago, whatever, a year ago. So, I mean, this is unbelievable turnover. Of course, there's something to look at here. I think there's some, you know, sometimes you look at a guy like Rob Painting and you wonder, is he better off as an assistant in charge of a very specific part of the field? Rob, make this go better. And not everyone's cut out for an almost political role that you have to play as a head coach of something like the Crusaders. So his ability to take it on and understand it in the middle. Right now, he's saying some things that I think might alienate some of his team. So I'm kind of watching that. They won't put up with it for very long. That's for sure. Colin Mansbridge and the guys at Crusaders, they are hard driving, excellence pursuing team. And that goes from culture all the way top to down, top to the bottom. So Something will happen. This will not continue the next season if this is what we're looking at.
Do you know anyone who isn't either secretly or just openly pleased that the Crusaders are doing badly for a change?
It's a great moral dilemma of the rugby world right now. Is it, I call it Bogan Freude, or do we have some bewildered pity?
Question the second for you. Over in the Premiership, are Bath for real this year?
Yeah, they are. So Johan van Kraan was a very good coach at the Bulls, a line-out guru, actually. He's all about the line-out. And they went to Munster and tried to place that sort of Northern Transvaal, Gauteng, Pretoria-type vibe on top of Munster. It didn't really work so well, but you see actually it set some seeds up. He's a good builder. At Bath, it really looks like there's balance. The club itself is very healthy. Johan has some really good assistants around him. You have a bit of magic that sort of balances out the Johan Dauer kind of building way with Finn. Yeah, I think they're a tough out. You know, I think they haven't seen the best of them yet. So let's look at it for the next 24 months. You might see something really strong there. It's a great ground to go play and watch. They really embrace the game day experience. There's a cachet in being a Bath supporter. So yeah, it's good fun.
So I never imagined, like, I watched them last year, and to my eyes, they were flat out bad last year. And I never imagined you could bring in one player that would turn a team around this much. But it feels like that's happened. Has Finn Russell been the difference this year?
Well, Finn has that ability at club level. He doesn't really, you cannot do that at test level, have one guy come in and do that. But there are other pieces to that. I mean, you have people like Sam Underhill. I think you have a very bolstered scrum. But I mean, so there's a kind of thought experiment that they had. I talked to an Australian coach once and at top level, and he said, you can give me like the 15 best players or you can give me the 5 best coaches, but I cannot have both. Which one do you want if I want to have good outcomes? Give me the coaches. I mean, assuming an acceptable super rugby level talent, but not the greatest. So I do think Van Kraan really gets some credit here of I think he learned lessons at Munster. And so I think he kind of had some do-overs to do, and, you know, full credit to the board at Bath that has really come in and said, Johan, you've got the reins and do what you need to do. They are going hunting too. I mean, they're always in the bidding now for all the good players. So I think some of the travails of the other clubs in England that are not managing their money very well has inured to the benefit of Johan and his boys. I mean, it's the big move to get Finn. You know, he didn't come cheap.
Yeah. So next question, I'm not even sure I want to hear the answer to this one. Should my beloved Free Jacks be worried about the team I call the Thundercats this year?
MLR is strange this year. I think it's a fluid year. I think everyone should worry about everyone. The only one that you're going to be really, you think like, why could not beat them is the Anthems. You come in the new one, you're going to ship some points. But it's interesting to me watching so far, like I didn't expect Houston Sabercats to go to Seattle and pull that off either. So
me neither.
I don't know. I think everyone's going to have to take a look at themselves. I do think the level of talent, skill, training, fitness has risen. Just like in the international game right now, there's some parity involved. So, yeah, no one can rest on their laurels. I think the Free Jacks are one of the teams that I always look at. You know, sort of my first look through the MLR, I take a few teams, and they're one of the teams that is a barometer. But, I just think everyone – can beat everyone now, except for the Anthems, probably.
Interesting. By the way, you kind of alluded to doing some work with an MLR team on the Pirate Rugby Pod just recently. Are you allowed to say which team you're actually working with? And if not, just what kind of role is it? What kind of work do you do with them?
Yeah, I'm fiercely guarded of my independence. I never want to get sucked into the team infrastructure. So I'm helping someone on the outside. I mean, helping a team just with moles. 4 categories: which moles should you not have formed when you did, which mole drives you actually did right to form, and then within that mole drive, what went wrong, what peeled off, and on the fence side, how do you attack it? The new conventional wisdom is to keep it stable because the referee will call, use it, and then it's gone. If you try to pierce it, swim it, split it, you end up getting pinged more often. But I will say, I can openly say that I am working with the guys in Monterrey, Mexico, on the next on the next wave of. Hold on, I get disconnected. Can you hear me? Yeah,
Your
I'm
picture
working
went
with.
sideways for a sec, but it's
Yeah,
fine.
I'm working with Monterrey in Mexico on that next entree of Major League Rugby. I would say my long-term interest is going to be in Monterrey, Mexico. I really want to work with expanding into that part of Latin America because I think it's unbelievably receptive to the idea of a football
Wow.
playing, kicking kind of collision sport, which I think is has always been the number one problem for Americans to grasp is how much of a kicking sport rugby is, and it is going to be the thing that either holds US back or not. But I do think, I think the expansion is wonderful. I think the Americas need to think of it as the Western Hemisphere, and that needs to be the prime focus. And I think there's unbelievable riches when you talk about Colombia, Panama, Brazil. Some of these places are just full of really good power winter athletes.
Interesting. I hadn't heard anything about the MLR thinking about expanding to Mexico. That's fascinating to me. Is this something they're thinking, 2 years, 10 years?
Yeah, it's next up. I would say within 12 months there'll be something more official. It's all about the fundraising. It's about site placement. It's about getting the teams behind it. What I think MLR has done really well, by the way, in contrast to England, is they haven't allowed teams and plans to not be economically sound. If there's one thing that's going to make the MLR one of the most successful stories in rugby 10 years from now, is because they didn't allow people to fudge numbers, break salary caps, and undermine the actual franchising plan. I think Americans are exceptionally good at that, by the way, anyway. The idea of franchising and the idea of making a league work, standing it up. So Mexico is an obvious expansion area. The northern part of Mexico, the Norteños, is way different from what we'll call the soccer mad south. So there's a lot of players there, not just expats, but like you just go around in Monterrey, you go to Saltillo, you go to some of the northern parts of Mexico, you're gonna see a different looking kind of athlete, and they're ready to play rugby.
Wow. That's amazing. I feel like we're breaking incredible news here. Question the fourth is swinging all the way back to France for the top 14, but can I start with giving you a weird stat for this year?
Hit me.
There's only been two draws in the top 14 this year, and both of them involved Clermont. Weird, right?
That is weird. What do you think? What do you figure about that?
I haven't any
What's
idea
the
what to make of it. I was looking through the table and I was like, does this mean that they're just really close to being there? Or just, I have no idea what that indicates.
I mean, top 14 is a home and away league. You typically win at home, or there's a big difference in gap in your performance, home and
Right.
away. Maybe that's it. It's just hard to get close. Sometimes, and actually, there's not a lot of close matches in top 14 in some ways, with exceptions. Like that one that just they just played between Toulouse and Bordeaux was a real
Oh my
cracker.
gosh, that was an incredible
Yeah.
game. So the actual question about the top 14, though, is 26 rounds too many? In the age of player welfare, does the top 14 need to consider cutting down their season a little bit?
I just don't know what to, we get into the idea of player welfare and people use that as a platitude or a trope. I mean, you can just take, without any demeaning anyone, but just take a car. You're buying a car, you're much more interested in the mileage than you are in the exact year that someone bought it, right? When you look at the head science and the idea of this, jelly-like substance in our skull that floats around and gets bruised, it doesn't only happen in catastrophic, things like I ran into the poles one time playing rugby, I was knocked out. That's an obvious problem for my brain. But I mean, just collisions, 260 tackles in a game in the World Cup, and then you multiply that by 13 tests, and then you add on about 14 games. A guy like Jasper Visa, the amount of G forces applied to his body as he's used as a battering ram is unbelievable. So the science probably is laughing at us when we talk about, you know, trying to card our way from a couple of collisions for a player in a year out of head knock health. The real thing is how many impacts you have in practice and in games. So there will come a time when we have some sort of max. It's just going to be like when you try to turn your leased car in. I'm sorry, you did 10,000 miles. I think that is got to be the way. French club owners are very powerful in the game of rugby. French rugby wields a big stick. You know, you can even be convicted of corruption in a court, like the Bernard Laporte, and he's working in Montpellier right now. So the very club that he was convicted of corruption with. So we haven't really got governance around some of these issues. I don't really take it seriously when they say player welfare, because no one would actually in their right minds put a player in there for 28 or 30 games in a season and expect that to have a good long-term effect on their brain and on their skeleton. So there'll have to be some regulations around that. I do think that's coming. It's going to come either reluctantly or by force. It might be part of a settlement of litigation, but it's absolutely going to be a thing we talk about is minutes in collision. And that's going to include practice time.
It's such a dramatic difference. I mean, 26 games versus 15 in Super Rugby, like it's almost double. It just seems kind of crazy.
Yeah, and the Kiwis do put a regulation both by Players Association and by agreement of NZRU and the clubs. So they do have sabbaticals. It's written in. I mean, even crucial matches between the Blues and the Chiefs, you'll see three or four guys sitting out.
Yeah. Well, this weekend, I know Damien McKenzie's not. He's going to be watching from his couch, I'm told, where they play the Crusaders. Seems amazing.
Yeah, so the Bucs do that too. South Africa has done that a lot, and they have players all over the world, so they have to sort of intervene. It's difficult when you have player contracts, and the one place where player contracts are the most difficult to bend is in France.
Interesting. Question the fifth. What's wrong with Matatu this year? You know, they beat the Chiefs Manawa by 2 points in an incredible final last season. And this year, they can't buy a bucket. What's going on with that women's team right now?
Oh, so now you've exceeded my level of rugby acumen. I really don't have any comment on that.
I found the line.
Yeah, that's beyond where my ship sails.
Well, I suppose that we should get to the actual things that I told you that we would be talking about, to be fair. My first real question was, like, what is your take with the South African teams in the URC now? It's been a couple of years. It's great to watch. You know, has it been, quote, good for rugby, unquote, in the Rainbow Nation? Is it better than when the similar teams were in Super Rugby?
It's an unmitigated success for all sides. The Welsh might argue a little bit there, but for the most part, the rise, the 3 million viewers and around, the spectacular attendance, 50,000, 45,000, 50,000, you know, week on week in South Africa, watching the same matchup. So 50,000 South Africans buying a ticket for Loftus to watch a matchup between the Stormers and the Bulls. And 4 years ago, those same teams would have met inside Super Rugby under the auspices of a different competition, but the same players, the same matchup, and they were drawing 25,000. So it's clearly better for South African rugby. There, of course, is some role of a repeat back-to-back World Cup win, but I think the URC appeals. It doesn't have a travel time zone deficit as it always did. Two-thirds of Super Rugby matches for South African teams were always played Antipodean. Versus on the reverse, New Zealand team would only be traveling a third of the time to Africa. So it always had that deficit, and with fine edges that plays out. URC, it's same time zone or 1 hour different. I do think each team has approached it differently. So with, Somers will actually play, I don't know, 55 players in a season because they're trying to balance both competitions. They've done well, reached the finals one in 1 year and came second another in the IRC. But in the Champions Cup, they really want to make a challenge. They're playing La Rochelle in the quarterfinals. So they're trying to balance that, having already tasted success. The Bulls are going all in on the league itself and saying, we're kind of going to jettison, if we have to, the cup challenge, but we're going to go and get that title because we think we're the ones who can beat Leinster over and over, unbeaten in the Dublin. The Lions are just a tough team who are, finding their way, but the money is much better for the Lions inside the ERK. It also has an overall effect for South Africa of bringing some players home. So you wouldn't have seen an Eben Etzebeth come back to the Sharks under the Super Rugby banner, but you would when he still gets to go play in Dublin against the best of the best. Sharks underperforming. Sharks are, if you look at the team sheet, you'd say, wow, you got a Ox Nchah, you got Bongi Mbonambe, you got Vincent Koch, and you got Eben Etzebeth 1 through 4. That's like probably one of the best 1 through 4s you'll find. And yet they cannot buy a game. But right now they're smashing all the top guys. So they have their players back. So they're going to be a spoiler inside the ERK. So the whole thing is really good. I think, the Bulls and the Stormers have a particularly strong identity. That's Western Province and Northern Transvaal. That's Pretoria. Cape Town, that's latte floppy-haired surfers against, the hard men of the heartland. It just plays out like, I don't know, in American football sense, it'd be like Oklahoma, OU versus USC. So you have every identity for a rivalry written in there, but you have new rivalries between South African teams and the Irish, which is a really sort of cool, spiteful, love you, hate you thing going on there. Edinburgh, I think, also embraces that idea. All the Celtic teams love coming down to Cape Town and Durban and playing in the middle of a winter, and now they're suddenly, in 90-degree heat up on the beach.
Well, the was it last year when Dweba got, I don't know if it's caught on video, celebrating when he found out that it would be Munster they were facing and, rather than Leinster. And I feel like that ignited that rivalry, between all of South Africa and all of Ireland in a way.
I mean, come on, Joe Dweba is a bit of a wanker, but he, you know, he's he was being true to form, just getting out, walking around with his daughter in his arms, just talking like a knob. Stormers are like a swashbuckling team, though. I mean, like basically, if you're from Cape Town, and this is where my roots are. You talk a lot. I mean, it's just it's like with it's like something that American viewers would really get into because it's not really that serious. And I think the Irish do take it maybe a little bit just Munster take things very seriously. And so and Ireland hasn't been on top of anything in the world for very long. So they're still coming to grips with being a rich nation, competing well, having a great rugby culture. It's like it's still not fitting them as easily as South Africa, where I mean you gotta boast. If you're walking around in Cape Town, you better be like swinging your stick and saying something, or it's not gonna go well. So yeah, it's a different culture, but I think the Irish are enjoying it actually. Almost like they're adopting South Africa as their new England to hate. But secretly also obsess on because they're recruiting players and coaches from South Africa like everyone else.
Well, we talked about, the South African teams participating in the URC versus Super Rugby. I almost feel like South Africa still could get like two more teams, like the Cheetahs and the Griquas, and maybe have them contending in Super Rugby. Am I just a ridiculous dreamer?
Well, what happened? I mean, it won't happen, but I like the idea. There's interesting in that almost every league took the best of the league that's below and you put them against the bottom of the league that's supposedly above. Like the best MLR teams, I think, would beat Newcastle, the Falcons, or at least they would beat them more often than not. I think some of the best teams in the top 14, I mean, the best teams in the League One in Japan would beat maybe a Western Force in Super Rugby. You could just play that out over and over. So you could cobble together a South African team, especially if you were unrestricted from where you pulled from, and they would do fine beyond the big boys. But I just don't think that's I think South Africa has really clearly decided to look to the north, to look to the same time zone as a long-term strategy, but they always want to have all black series. And so what's going to go on is increasingly you'll see South Africa pull away from the rugby championship as an idea in 2025, 2026 maybe, and then try to, have more all black tours back and forth. So three all black matches in South Africa, three Springbok matches in New Zealand. And I think they've kind of given up on the SANZAAR vessel, if you will.
What's your take on all the talk about South Africa being included in the Six Nations or expanding the Six Nations to include them? Is that something that's going to happen? Do you want that? Do you think it's a good idea?
I mean, it should happen. You have two different reasons structurally why it won't. One is the Six Nations is a closed shop. All the unions have to vote on it. So, you know, Italy has basically a veto. It took them 24 years to really have what you'll call a successful Six Nations. So there's a showing there that they're waiting on that. They want it to be short flights. They want people to be able to fly from Edinburgh to Rome, Ryanair, 1 hour flight over to Dublin. And they don't want it to turn into a South African trek or epic voyage. Other thing is they're worried the South Africa would do too well. It would mess up the story, the narrative of the Northern Hemisphere, you know, cup. They do preach tradition, even though they've had Italy in there, and Italy for at least 20, like I said, 23 years was a guaranteed win for teams like England and Ireland that could pad their stats. So it's not really that traditional. South Africa has been playing Scotland since 1890, playing Wales since 1890 as well. So, and then even the French came in pretty late. So I just think that there's some resistance there to hard to overcome. The other thing is the calendar gets very strange. So then we have to talk about the global calendar, and I think that is coming. So I think South Africa is patient enough to say, let's see what that looks like. As long as we have regular All Black tours, we don't mind getting rid of the Rugby Championship, because it's always been viewed as something that wasn't that important. It was just individual matches between the All Blacks and Springboks, the Springboks and the Wallabies. It was never about the actual format of the Rugby Championship for South Africans. But if they got into the Six Nations, then they'd want to win it. And they probably would quite a bit. Like it might even turn into like every other year. So, and that would make nobody happy in the North.
You know, I told you I was going to ask this, but then as I was getting ready, I was like, this is kind of an ass kissy type question, but I'm going to stick with it anyway. Are the Springboks the best team in the world right now? Andy Farrell seems to think so.
Well, I mean, we don't have – our sport doesn't really do this. So first of all, we have seasons that don't coincide. We have competitions that are not overlapping. I would say this. When everyone can get all their people in the same place and they have their 12 weeks to get ready and it's the best of the best and it's called the Rugby World Cup, that tends to go – South Africa's way recently, but you could also argue that New Zealand has had the same or better run. I think it's the age of parity. So between South Africa, Ireland, and New Zealand, there's not a hair's breadth of difference. But if you put it to, but we get all our guys. So just take a look at the South African team, which is why, you know, I would say when you get them all together, they are the best. The BOC 23, just the actual 23 that you would take, pretty much it's like South Africa, England, Japan, France, Japan, Ireland, Japan, South Africa, Ireland, Japan, England, France, Ireland, Japan. That was the makeup of the team. So there's no way to play them, whereas Ireland is Leinster, Munster. So for Ireland to say, it's not about the World Cup because it's about the cohesion of the every, you know, during the year when they play, sometimes they're very woeful, Wales and Italy, and then they create themselves, or the best. It's silly. When put to the test, they've always struggled to play the box well, and it's mostly been in Dublin. But when you actually go to a tournament and a cup and you say it's going to be who can win four in a row against the big boys, that seems to be something New Zealand and South Africa can do better than Ireland. There's just a durability, a depth, a bloody mindedness, whatever that comes down in the business end of these cups. And it looks like the Springboks do that the best. Looks like the All Blacks can also be right there. And then in the middle of those cycles, New Zealand has the best record. Lately, Ireland has challenged that. I do think for a lot of us, we're looking at this tour coming up in South Africa. I'll be there for both tests in Pretoria and Durban, where we can smash each other and decide it. Now, there's always going to be a caveat because Ireland will say, no, it wasn't South Africa. And we'll say, yeah, but like 14 of the last 16 matches with Ireland have been in Dublin. So we want to come and moor you down there. But it's going to be different fields, high altitude, very hard, very quick. You know, they might melt in the heat. But, yeah, it's not going to settle anything. That's the beauty of rugby. It goes on and on and on. And you know, so Ireland will you in the same breath say the reason why we can know that we're the best is we beat you in the World Cup, and they say the World Cup doesn't matter. So it's just one of those things that sports fans love. I do think if you have all your players together and you have an extended amount of time, the Springboks will end up having a better result against more top teams than Ireland will, because I don't think that Ireland can beat New Zealand in that top end as well as the Springboks can. But I think also Ireland has particular attributes and traits that make it hard on the box. So I think you're in a situation where you have the box, Ireland and New Zealand top, and then you have a rung below, the French and the English. You should have Australia and probably will pretty soon with Joe Schmidt. And then you have the rest.
I'm curious about the, so the last World Cup, South Africa won those final three games by 1 point each. Does that tell us that they're, you know, incredible because they find a way to win even when the margins are that thin? Or does it tell us that any of those teams actually could have been crowned champions?
It does not say the latter. If you look at all the World Cups together as a 10 tournament sample size, you do see the same teams rising to the top. It's very difficult to keep doing it. For example, a thought experiment would say, so England, Andre Pollard misses his kick, England survives, and they go play the All Blacks. They get smashed in the final. They just, that they've already played their final, they're done. It's very difficult to be the box and do that three times in a row. It's very difficult to be the All Blacks, lose to French in the first game, and then come back and just get better and better. That's a particular strength of a team. So I'll just take Will Jordan at his word. Will Jordan was put the same question to him, and he just said, no, it shows championship mettle. It shows that they know how to be unbelievably focused and when it really matters, they find a way. Not many teams facing that French blowtorch. I was in the stadium, and it was the loudest thing I'd ever been in. Wow. Where the French were just scoring at will. It looked like they were just running away with it. There was a moment there where you just thought, this could be a blowout. Not very many teams in Paris with that rabid guillotine-wielding crowd wanting to kill everyone, including the ref, could have fought their way back in, scored, 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 and ended up taking it and knocking them out pretty convincingly in the end. Scored, notwithstanding. That's just difficult to do. Ireland doesn't do that very much in Paris. New Zealand struggled to do that. Most teams have struggled to do that. So I do think the box have a particular way of being us against the world. They're just tough. And I think that's something, you know, if you grew up there, you realize, you know, just walking down the street, you might have to do that. You might have to fight your way home.
How much of that championship medal comes from Rassi? You know, you already talked about, you know, give me the best coaches possible. If you took him out and substituted Joe Schmidt in there, did the Bucks win this recent World Cup?
So Rassi is definitely a guy who picks well. He selects players who can handle his vibe. He's a really ruthless selector on always defense first, being able to double back almost like an NFL cornerback. On his wings, the number of miles that they put on those wings is unbelievable compared to other teams. Rossi is therefore committed to standards and has a physio, as his best mate, Jock Nienaber, that's very numbers oriented. So that's the side of Rossi that's what I'll call scientific, innovative. That's truly good. And it would work wherever he went. You could put Rossi in a lot of places and his stuff would work. I do think there's another side of him, which is the emotional roller coaster, a lot of flaws, a lot of emotional baggage, a lot of, you know, chips on shoulders and such that really only translates probably in South Africa. And so maybe it's even, you know, it works better there. But I mean, his assistants love him. Assistants will walk over broken glass for him. And that's including Irish assistants. That's including anyone. That's New Zealanders. He's a fun guy. He's funny and he's down to earth. So I do think there's a vibe there that works, and I think it would work almost anywhere. So I think he's an interesting guy. He's probably one of the most interesting cats we have in our sports. People sometimes hate him, sometimes love him. I think if you're around him for any time at all, you don't hate him. So you end up liking the guy.
When he pulled Monty Lebok really early in that game, And a lot of people were speculating. Well, some people were speculating, no, he probably told him ahead of time. LeBlanc knew that was going to happen. But most people were saying, this might ruin this kid forever. That might completely leave him damaged goods. Doesn't look that way this year. He looks good to me. It looks like if that affected him, he's really bounced back. What was your take on all that?
Nah, it won't affect Monty at all. Monty's a good lad. He's true blue. Andre and Monty are good friends. That team ethos that they built, and it was going on since 2018, is really de-emphasizing, that kind of prima donna behavior. There's no doubt at all that I was pushing. I was saying Andre Pollard's the player 34A. He's coming. He's coming. When Hooker goes down, they'll bring in Andre Pollard or a tight forward. He was always going to be the sharpshooter. He fits that particular way of playing, and so it made a lot of sense. There were seeds of that. You saw Monty a little bit in even the Scotland game, seeing some things, and yeah, he has his moments of brilliance, but also in terms of taking a game and saying this is my game, against Ireland in the 8-13 loss, it was obvious that you needed a field general. The amount of experience, if you took the field with that final Bock team in the final, was unbelievable. I mean, you look at the just people who had played three cups together. You had, Pfaff, Andre, and then Damien Delaney on his other shoulder. That's a matrix. Damien Delaney was there in the semifinal loss in 2015, right next to 20-year-old Andre Pollard.
Wow.
You're scrumming down with Frans Malherbe, and Steve Kitsoff. Well, these guys played together when they were 17 years old in Cape Town. So that is where you bring them all back from all the different parts of the world, the diaspora of South Africa, and you put them together. And that includes fans, by the way. In the fans at these matches in the World Cup, we were all from everywhere. You're in line, you say, hey, where are you from? From Manchester. But where are you really from? Ah, Cape Town. So you have this kind of coming back together again. Pollard, sharpshooter, Montpellier, Leicester. I mean, he fits right back in because he's literally looking at guys he's played since under 20s, Somerset West.
So you're somebody who loves the scrum. A lot of people complain about it nowadays. You've already kind of alluded to it. People saying, "Oh, it's too many scrum resets. This takes too long. That's too slow." We're trying to grow this sport here in America, and it's in some ways the hardest to understand aspect of the game. And I've been talking to other people about this too. The comms, not only do they not explain it, they seem proud of the fact that they don't know what they're looking at. The comms don't just say, "Well, I think this was this kind of penalty." They kind of say, "Oh, well, the dark arts are happening there. Who knows what that penalty was for?" It's almost like they brag about the fact that they're not qualified to describe what we're looking at. What do you think needs to be done to sort of increase, especially here in America, where it's, in its infancy in terms of commercial success? What can be done to improve our understanding of what we're looking at when a scrum is happening?
Yeah, there's two reasons. The main reasons why that is really stupid, what you just described, that phenomenon. I know what you're talking about. I hear it. First of all, America is particularly suited, if they want to rise in rugby, to the scrum. It would be the avenue for USA to get into the top 10, would be what Georgia, the country of Georgia, has used. And maybe we could use the state of Georgia. But there is a mentality in America that just fits the heaving, panting, mud in your face, elbow in your gut kind of scrum situation. We know that because of the love affair America has with contact sports, collision sports, with the inner workings of shedding a blocker on the defensive line, of a nose guard that's described as a water plug or like John Madden type poetry for the common man that extols the virtue of man on man winning the line of scrimmage, which sounds a lot like scrummage. And there are heroes, there's a reason why America falls in love with the Travis Kelce's brother, because he's more everyman. So the scrum is an avenue for people who don't fit the six pack, sprinter mode. And so there's plenty of corn-fed, beefy boys that need to get into the scrum. So that's stupid to steer away from a thing that could be the way that an American rugby team out-muscles and bullies, absolutely bullies the Italians, bullies the Scots, bullies the Irish. That's a much easier sell than getting a whole cadre of people who know how to play 9, 10, fly. Like, it's just, that's 80 years of IQ versus, it doesn't really matter. The French just import people from all over the place and say, I've got a behemoth. I got six behemoths. Can you match me? So the scrum is a beautiful thing for Americans to fall in love with. Second, it is literally how you start to choose a team. At juniors, you're literally walking up and the first thing you got to find is someone who can run for 80 minutes who's kind of fat. And, that's a tricky thing to recruit. But you got to start there. You got no team without a tight end. So you start there and you build around it. Literally, it is it's the archetype of our game. It's the picture. It's the most unique thing. It is something to be celebrated. If you actually get into it and you stop doing what you just said about, dismissing it, it's a beautiful part of the game. It is dramatic. You are literally turning the game. As less scrums form now, about half of what it used to, but more apt to be pinged. So the ratio of penalized scrums is now up versus non-penalized. It brings drama to a set piece. It says, when we say the set piece matters and there's continual contest for the ball, it's not so much about hooking the ball down a straight throw. That's gone. It's about being able to crumble your scrum, make you sweat, make you squeal. I'm going to stick my head up your armpit and make you cry. And there's something in close quarters about that. When you get the beef on someone at a scrum, your ear and his ear are right next to each other. You are imprecating oaths about his family. He's literally hating you. And that's a beautiful thing. That's the brutal ballet of rugby. If you want to ever stay away from that, that's dumb. No sport ever grew by being ashamed and embarrassed of their roots. If you are what you are, do that thing. So I don't think UFC is shrinking right about now. It's growing. Because why? Because they embrace the knockout. Rugby is a scrummaging game. It's built for people who look like, who want to scrum. It should never devolve into an NBA style, with scores of 48 to 48. That's not to be celebrated. You want a game that's somewhere in the 20s, 16-6, 10-5. You want a real rough, tough, and that can appeal to, I think, the American collision winter sport athlete far more than what I'll call, dressed up sevens.
Bill Simmons, the podcaster and sports writer, he had this idea that you could sell fake cauliflower ears. And then so if you're going to some place that's dangerous, you just put them on, because everyone instantly sees that and goes, whoa, 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 don't mess with that guy. He's used to getting his head squished and clearly doesn't care.
That's true. But rugby fans are the best. We can sit with each other. We don't need to have a security separating us. You can sit, one guy can sit in a sea of opposition and no one's going to hurt you. But the game itself is born of conflict. I mean, the reason why countries like South Africa fell in love with rugby was a way of refighting the Boer War against the English. It was, it's crime pardon. It's basically a series of crimes that are okay. They're excused. So, the best teams are always looking for edges. And I think American rugby could do a lot worse than seeking an edge with physical, brute strength and power. Like for the MLR team that I think is doing really well this year in terms of embracing that is the Houston Sabercats. The damn Sabercats are bringing in people who don't mind that style of rugby. And you look at Heineke Meyer, former Springbok coach, is saying, we can recruit around this, not just bringing in SAFAs, but actually the American athlete can fit into that mode and say, you're going to win every collision.
I'm incredibly bummed to say that I have to wrap this up. I'm literally using vacation hours in the middle of the day here at work, and I don't want to push my luck. But before I let you go, I saw on your Roar profile a quote from Benjamin Franklin. In fact, it reads, never confuse motion with action. Can you tell us, what does that mean to you? Why did you choose that quote?
Well, it's apt for rugby in particular because if you just look at the casual fans' taste, sometimes they go, they want phases. They want 23 phases. Oh, my God. They put together 23 phases. But when you look at what happened in those 23 phases, they went backward, then forward, then backward, then forward, then backward, then forward, because 50% of the gain line collisions went the other way. And then you predictably knocked on or someone pilfered it or you ran out of, into touch. So action can look a lot more like, meaningful motion, where you win a scrum penalty and then you hit a perfectly, weighted line drive kick to the touch and you're 5 meters out. I put it to the Twitter audience and I just said, I'll give you five of these things, you know, five regathered kicks, five scrum penalties, five line breaks, or five stolen lineouts. That's just the eventuality you have. Pick one. No other variables discussed. Just, you know, take those. And an expert divided that back and forth, and five scrum penalties was the thing, because that's real action. Just having five line breaks where you split the defense and you're now in clear space sounds lovely, but we all know that there's 15 players on the field to defend. Scramble defense usually catches you. Most teams do get five line breaks. Doesn't mean they score anything. So that kind of mindset about rugby is it's such a complicated game, and I love it, because what might appear like tremendous motion is not leading to any real action.
Well, of course, as Confucius said, it does not matter how slowly you go as long as you do not stop.
That's a good one.
Harry Jones, I can tell I'm about to get kicked out of this conference room. Thank you so much for joining me here. What do you got coming up on your own pod? Do you have any special guests you want to preview? Any plugs you've got?
Yeah, so we do Game of the Week every week, and then we're doing we have fantastic guests. So you'll look at our roster of guests, you'll love them. The guy coming up this week is Rian Lowe, who's a great YouTuber, and very funny. And for someone who's just getting into the game, he's such a good channel of explaining things and getting into the nitty-gritty of the game. I have a column writing for the Roar, and also write for SA Rugby. But at the Roar, I'm going to be talking about the leagues and trying to put, I don't know, some kind of character on each of these different leagues, and how they kind of all serve a role in our rugby family. And we shouldn't be looking down on any of them. We shouldn't be making fun of any of them. It's actually really interesting how they all function. Some of them provide us tests and trials that we really need. So, yeah, look for that. I think it's going to be Monday or Tuesday in the Roar.
That's one of the very reasons I love watching so much rugby is – I can, you know, watch a game that's happening in New Zealand in Super Rugby in the morning, and then there's a game happening in Bath in the afternoon, and then there's one happening in Paris at night. Like, and all those games look and feel completely different.
It's really fascinating how different they do look. So I suppose there's emphases. We have a game where so many things could be refereed, but you don't have to. So if you put your emphasis on ruck speed, or if you put your emphasis on speed in general, and then, you know, it looks one way. And then there's other leagues that really focus more on the power reset, almost more like a gridiron idea, where you say, kind of want there to be some gaps and lulls, because you're going to be rewarded because our smashes will be better. I think there's those laboratories are playing out. I do think we should look at what the audience does like. So I do think attendance is important, and we shouldn't just keep trying to attract some mythical tribe of rugby followers. It doesn't exist yet, but if we could just get them to be more excited, they'd follow us. I think we should always reward the people who do follow us right now and listen to them very closely.
This has been absolutely fantastic. I really appreciate your time. I'd love to have you come back in maybe in a couple of months and talk about how some of these competitions have been going. Harry Jones, you're a scholar and a gentleman. Thank you for your time. Cheers. Talk to you soon. And be well.
Cheers, David. Thanks.